Hey, you're listening to the Words on Flick show with me, Janine Coveney. You're listening to the Words on Flick show on eWater Radio, KEWR-DB.
The views and comments expressed do not reflect the opinions of eWater Radio. All comments and views are show guest views and comments and in no way reflect views or comments of eWater Radio, KEWR-DB, or its affiliates.
Hey, welcome to the February 20th, 2022 edition of the Words on Flick show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Janine Coveney. And for many, February is the toughest month of the winter season, principally because of the weather. And we've had some interesting weather over the past couple of weeks. Snow and ice and gale force winds and all of that good stuff that we love about winter, right? On the East Coast, especially. But for others, it's a time to celebrate loved ones with Valentine's Day on the 14th. And if you had a Valentine to celebrate, more love and more power to you. But we know February now as Black History Month, bringing to light the accomplishments and stories of people of color whose lives really made a difference to us all and to American culture and history. And because the Words on Flix podcast focuses on films old and new, I decided that we should take a look at a real film pioneer, Mr. Gordon Parks. So I wanted to celebrate the life and work of this pioneering African-American auteur, image maker, author, composer, and humanitarian, because he really did make incredible strides. And I think, you know, just 2020 hindsight, looking at his work, and just looking at the body of the incredible things that he was able to accomplish and do, it really is amazing. Like his artistic eye, his sensitivity, his boldness, and his dedication at a time when people of color were still not afforded opportunities or respect. All of this stuff is like indelible to our culture now, in ways that maybe people don't always recognize or acknowledge, you know. So I wanted to focus on him. And unfortunately, I didn't get a chance to meet Mr. Parks before the man himself passed away on March 7, 2006 at age 94. So he has been gone for quite a while now, but his influence is still with us. There's been a lot of celebration of Gordon Parks in his work of late, and rightly so. We've been seeing more documentaries about him, a new documentary that was done recently, which I'll talk about in a little bit. You know, he was this super Renaissance man who did not allow the prejudices and racial strictures of the time dictate or truncate his opportunities. He was an astonishing trailblazer on so many fronts, right? He was this photojournalist whose work made serious social and cultural impact for decades. Like, he photographed for major national magazines targeted to a wide readership. He documented people of color. He documented Harlem. He documented white farmers in the Dust Bowl. He photographed people in Latin America. He photographed fashion models in Paris. He was also the original photographer of the classic jazz photograph A Great Day in Harlem in 1958. And in a really historical coup, he was also the photographer of the 1998 recreation A Great Day in Hip Hop, where all of the prominent members of the rap and hip hop scene gathered together in Harlem to recreate that photograph. He's the writer and director of the Learning Tree film, which is the first major studio film to be written and directed by an African American. And he's the director of the groundbreaking film Shaft, which was a critical and box office hit that launched a whole genre of blaxploitation films that ultimately saved the studio system by drawing a lot of people back into movie theaters at a time when the studio system was struggling. So that's a major coup just by itself. But wow, he was such a remarkable figure. Perhaps his sense of perseverance and survival and just his observational eye came from a somewhat tumultuous youth, right? So Gordon Parks was born in Fort Scott, Kansas on November 30th, 1912, as the youngest of 15 children. Can you imagine that? Like, at the time he was born, he had siblings that were already grown and out of the house, right? He lived on a family farm. He grew up in the teens and 20s. His mother died when he was 14, though. So he was sent to Minnesota to live with an older sibling, an older sister, and her husband. They didn't get along, so he got kicked out at age 15. So he had to survive on his own at a pretty young age. I think that was semi-common for people growing up at that time. Like, you were a man, you were considered a woman while you were still a teenager, but still, to not have that family support must have really made a huge impression on him. He had to survive, he had to get along with people, he had to fit in, get in where he fit in. And according to documentation, he worked in a number of unusual and difficult situations. He worked in brothels. He worked as a singer, as a piano player, so he could play music from a young age. He was a busboy. He was a traveling waiter. And it even says he was a semi-pro basketball player. So he had skills on multiple levels. He even worked in a gentleman's club called the Minnesota Club in 1929, probably at the height of the Great Depression or the start of the Great Depression. And then he headed to Chicago, and he had this childhood dream of making images with a camera after having been impressed by photographs of migrant workers that he saw at the age of 8 in a magazine. So he always wanted to make images. So he bought a camera and taught himself how to use it. That's dedication. So his photographic work impressed the wife of heavyweight champion Joe Louis, and she convinced him to come to Chicago and keep working as a photographer among the people that she knew. So he was able to start a successful portrait business in Chicago, and he was photographing all levels of people, but he was successful shooting a lot of Chicago socialites. So eventually he got a fellowship that got him some money, and then he was asked to join the Farm Security Administration. So now he's working for the federal government to document social conditions across the nation in the 1930s and 40s. So here in a short clip from the Merv Griffin Show from the early 60s, even Merv Griffin is impressed by all that Gordon Parks has gone through in his life before getting to the point of being a film director. Listen.
Gordon Parks' personal history includes a Kansas farm, a Minneapolis brothel, a flophouse in Chicago, a St. Paul jail. The story of one American who overcame loneliness, the depression, poverty, and his color to find security and the beginnings of a success. His book is titled A Choice of Weapons. Here is Gordon Parks.
So his body of work as a photojournalist for the government, for magazines, and as a portraitist is well documented, But with the Words on Flicks podcast, I wanted to focus this month on his work as a filmmaker.
The books that Gordon Parks wrote were hugely influential when they were published. His first, The Learning Tree, which I already mentioned, was later developed into a film that he wrote the screenplay for, he directed and wrote the score for, which is major, major accomplishments. And also A Choice of Weapons, which was a chronicle of the next part of his life from the 1920s through the 1940s, where you really see the struggles that he went through in facing down poverty, in facing down racial segregation and prejudice from the people that he encountered. You see how he clings to the notion of social justice and wanting to be an artist, and how his choice of weapon is indeed a camera.
The learning tree by rivers that flow in the night, winds that blow after sundown. That's what a boy should know. Fireflies and restless stars in tall fields of corn, where all June bugs are born in the due time. That's where a boy should grow. Broad skies round us pass, clouds puffed white as snow, with two dawns by his side, and a nice girl to know. Out where the sparrow flies, where bluebirds spring after moon die, there grows the learning tree.
Okay, as concerns the learning tree, this movie had a very profound effect on me, I have to say, because it was the story of a young black boy growing up in the Midwest in the 1920s, which was quite far from my own experience growing up in the 1960s and 70s in New York City. So I was surprised to learn a couple of things about how Gordon Parks grew up, which was that his family ran a successful farm. They weren't sharecroppers. They owned their own land. That the school that the young boy went to as he was growing up was not fully segregated, which I found surprising, but it's explained that there wasn't a big enough school system within the town for there to be two separate schools. However, the film does make clear that the teachers are fully biased against black students, and that they definitely tried to squash any kind of really ambitious dreams that Black students had. They, you know, traditionally tried to steer them, even though they received an elementary education, a high school education, they traditionally tried to steer them into menial jobs that they thought only Negroes should or could hold. And you see that in a scene with the young boy, the protagonist, and his teacher, who's trying to guide him as he confesses that he wants to go on to college, and the teacher definitely tries to dissuade him. I think the film is also important in showing the different ways that Black people approach their own existence within the country. You know, we know that there was segregation. We know that there was prejudice. We know that there was widespread abuse and violence against people of color. And so you have a character who is a friend of the main protagonist, another young boy, who did not believe in any possible opportunities for his future, who did not believe in education, who was not a striver, and believed that nothing good could come to him. And so he was doomed to a life of crime, to a life of jail, to a life of poverty. And so you see those two lives juxtaposed within the course of the film. I think one of the saddest elements of the story is you have this young love story where the young boy is in love with, you know, a classmate of his, a beautiful young Black girl, and the Black girl is lured by a white classmate, a white male classmate, and as you would say, ruined, quote unquote, raped, assaulted by this white boy, and becomes pregnant. And so her life totally changes, and her family takes her away to have the baby. And so the young man loses his love to this really unfortunate situation where, you know, Black women always bear the weight of abuse, misogyny, racism, injustice, and the sense that they can be used and thrown away by a prominent white boy in the town. And no one does anything about it. No one says anything about it. It's just really a sad situation. This film was really well done, considering that it was the first production by Gordon Parks as a director. I mean, there are some things that are a little rough about it, but overall, it's a really beautiful film to look at in terms of how it's photographed, and you see, you know, all the elements of the Kansas prairie and the farmland and the river that the boys like to swim and fish in. And the storms that can come up in Kansas, particularly tornadoes. And you have a scene really early on in the film where there's a tornado, and the young boy can't get back to his family's house in the storm cellar. So he takes shelter in a barn with the local floozy, who gives him a little bit of an education as they shelter in from the storm. You know, and all of these things are part of a young man's growing up, and it really offers an intimate portrait of the joy and pain of growing up Black in this time. And I think it's an eye-opening film because there's never been a portrayal of this type of character, of the inside look at Black life at that time. Now, certainly before Gordon Parks came along, there were filmmakers such as Oscar Michaud, who wrote and directed and produced films about Black life. And these were often, you know, serious dramas and melodramas and sort of like crime stories, like slick crime stories. But we didn't have like a sensitive story about a young man's coming of age, a young Black man's coming of age in the Midwest. And I just love this film. Whenever it's on TCM or one of the other channels, I always want to see it because I love how it's developed. You know, the relationship with his mother becoming sick, his relationship with his blind uncle who teaches him a few things about life. And just, you know, the thing about growing up is you learn that, unfortunately, that there's as much pain in life as there is joy and happiness, and how you as a person can get past the disappointments and the pain and still find joy in life. And I think, you know, this film really shows that. It's actually one of my favorites and highly recommended, and you can see it on YouTube. It's, you know, it's there. Please check out this film. And it shows Gordon Parks as a really important filmmaker. So he made the film The Learning Tree. He went on to also make Shaft. And there is a current HBO documentary about Gordon Parks called A Choice of Weapons, inspired by Gordon Parks. And this is a wonderful documentary because you not only get to see the inspirations for his work, you learn about his life, where he came from, what he wanted to accomplish in his work. You get an overview of some of his most famous photograph, and you learn about his filmmaking. But you also hear interviews from social commentators, college professors, academics, other journalists, about his influence and his impact and what drove him and why his work is so important. You can watch A Choice of Weapons, inspired by Gordon Parks, on HBO or HBO Max if you have it. It's really, really a wonderful overview of his work and why Gordon Parks is so important as an image maker and as an arbiter of social change. Okay, so while A Choice of Weapons is getting a lot of attention on HBO and people are talking about it again, there was a previous Gordon Parks documentary from a few years ago, I believe it was 2012, directed by Craig Lawrence Rice and narrated by Alfre Woodard, and it's called Half Past Autumn. And this was the name of a photographic exhibition held at the National Art Museum, or I should say the National Museum of Art in Washington, D.C., just around the early 2000s, I think before Gordon Parks passed away. So he was able to discuss how the exhibition was going to be put together, the flow of it, what kind of materials were going to be included. And so the documentary takes a look at that, but it also exposes, you know, his other art forms, right? His original compositions, his symphonic works, and also his poetry. So you have a lot of sections of the documentary where you're looking at his images, his still images, his moving images from his films, and listening to several noted actors recite his poetry, and it really gives you another look at his artistic work, you know, the full 360 of how he approached his work. And it truly is a look at an American, a truly original, up by his bootstrap, self-taught artist whose work was able to speak to a broad range of people and documented a broad range of people. But he spoke his truth, and, you know, it's great to hear it in all of its many shades of dark and light, whether through language, through music, or through visual imagery.
And here's just a brief example at the very beginning of the documentary.
I would miss this canvas land, wide prairie filled with green and corn stalk, the flowering apple, tall elms and oaks beside the glinting streams, cloud tufts spilling across the round blue sky, butterflies to chase through grass high to the chin, June bugs, swallowtails, red robin, and bobolink. Nights filled with soft laughter, fireflies, and restless stars. Yes, all this I would miss, along with the fear, hatred, and violence we blacks have suffered upon this beautiful land.
And so I highly recommend Half Past Autumn, and you can find it online and watch it, I think, for free, actually. I first saw it on Turner Classic Movies, I think, at the beginning of this year, or just as Black History Month was about to start. And so this will give you another great insight into his life and work. But now, I think we want to talk about Shaft, don't we? Isn't that what everybody wants to talk about? Okay, so I have a confession to make. All right, I can't believe I'm telling you this, Words on Flicks fans, but your girl Janine has actually never seen Shaft from beginning to end. I was too young to go to the theater to see it. I think when it came out, I was about 12 or 13. And, you know, I wasn't going to be allowed to go to the theater to see this explosive movie full of sex and violence at that age. But, of course, I was not unaware of the impact that it had on everyone. Everyone was talking about this film. Everyone was talking about the power of the hero of Richard Roundtree, how badass he was. And of course, the music, the soundtrack, the Isaac Hayes soundtrack was a staple in my home. And I listened to the album over and over and knew every track on it. And in fact, when I started the Words on Flicks podcast back in 2019, Cafe Reggio, a track from the album, was my theme song. So what I propose to do, because I have seen bits and pieces of it on television, but at this moment, I don't think I've ever seen the film in one complete sitting and been able to get all of the nuances of the story. Unlike Superfly, I've seen Superfly many, many times, and I've seen other blaxploitation films, But this was the film that started it all, and I've never actually seen it. So I'm going to watch it, and then I'm going to come back and share my impressions of it, okay? All right.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man? Can you dig it? The cat that won't cop out when there's danger all about. Chef. Right on. You see, this cat chef is a bad mother.
Shut your mouth.
What I'm talking about, chef?
Well, he can do
it. He's a complicated man, but no one understands him but his woman.
John Chef.
Okay, I actually just finished watching Shaft for the first time. And okay, you know what? I really have not seen much of this movie at all. I know it just seems crazy, but you know, you can't see everything. Okay, so the movie came out in 1971. It is directed by the man of the show, the man of the hour, Gordon Parks. And he did a really good job in terms of filming within New York City. And there were a lot of shots, a lot of locations. He's got a pretty good cast. I mean, you know, well, okay. I liked this movie. That's what I want to get to. I liked it. And I was worried that I might not like it because some of the politics and the cultural climes have changed so much, particularly in terms of how we look at black-on-black violence and how we look at misogyny and how women are treated, which are the usual tropes that we can object to in a lot of blaxploitation films. But, you know, there wasn't that much of that in this. It was a pretty straightforward detective story. And it's pretty good. It's a little slow in places, but that's indicative of the times in which the film was made. I mean, this film was a big event, okay? And I can definitely see why. So, okay, so why did I like it? Well, first of all, if you have read any of my classic film reviews, and I recommend that you do, at wordsonflicks.blogspot.com, then you know that I really love movies about dirty old 1970s New York City. 1960s is good, but 1970s is the pinnacle of New York City excess, ugliness, crime, crowding, neon, triple X theaters, just the clothes and the way people spoke and the subway. You know, that's what I remember about my native city. And I love seeing it again on film. And for many years, I actually worked in and around Times Square. It wasn't the 70s. I didn't start working full time after college till the 80s, but I was right there in Times Square when the XXX theaters were still there and there was still a lot of crime on the streets before it all got Disney-fied. So I was super gratified to see the opening montage with Shaft, Richard Roundtree, popping out of the subway station right in Times Square, and we get a 360 degree view of what is going on in the heart of the city. So we know that Shaft is a badass right from the beginning because he rises up out of the subway. He's clad in this fly leather coat that a character actually comments on later in the film about how fly his leathers are. And he just walks across the street without looking, without worrying about traffic at all. You know, taxis have to stop for him. He don't give a damn. He's giving the finger. He's cussing people out. Like, he is in the roughest part of town and he knows how to navigate. So this is a man who is fully confident. And you know, he is a character we haven't seen much on screen up to that point, up to 1971, right? A slick, streetwise, but still noble character. He gives money to kids on the street. He's a protector of women, even though he's a little bit of a player. And he knows right from wrong, and he's not going to take shit from anybody, black or white. He doesn't care. And that's fantastic. And this is part of why the film was so important, because he was not, as a character, Richard Roundtree, as a character, Shaft, he wasn't kowtowing to anybody. He wasn't bowing down or holding back or stepping back. Look, even when he gets shot, he's like, oh, tape me up, wrap me up. I got to get on my feet. I got to get going. You know, like he's ready to go. Okay, so the other thing is, as a woman, again, I thought that I might be, you know, I might find some of the scenes in this film objectionable because, you know, of the misogyny and abuse against women that you find in a lot of these blaxploitation films. But Richard Roundtree is a freaking dreamboat, okay? He's fine as hell. He's clean as a whistle. He's getting his shoes shined and looking like he stepped out of a bandbox, whatever that means, at the beginning of the film. And he even looks clean, like, after having a knockdown, drag-out fight in his office in Times Square at the beginning of the movie, where one guy goes right out the window. But, you know, okay, he is not perturbed by this in the least. And when the cops threaten him with, you know, jail time and catching charges for this incident, he's like, you know, whatever, do what you will. He doesn't care. So Shaft is sort of like a classic detective story with a, you know, with a mystery trouble that knocks on his door. And then the police are pressuring him to give them information and solve the crime at the same time. So it makes me think of a lot of different movies, including Devil in a Blue Dress, and what's the Eddie Murphy one, Beverly Hills Cop. You know, there's a personal friend or some incident in the neighborhood with people that you know where things have gone wrong, and the detective is called upon to fix it. And then the police get wind of it, and they're putting pressure on that detective, too. It's classic, not just black detective stories, any detective story. So it hews to that classic pattern. And I think it's interesting because you see how the character navigates not just Harlem, but, you know, he can be in Midtown. He lives in the Village. He's not afraid of white folks. He backtalks white folks in their, you know, in their bias and their prejudice. But the other thing that I like about it is that even though he's not a pushover for Whitey, he has this great relationship with the police captain, and they, you know, they kind of rib each other. But in the end, you know, Chef does the right thing and crime doesn't pay and justice is done. Okay. So I love Moses Gunn, and I was a little bit worried that Moses Gunn as Bumpy, there was going to be some other element to his character where the daughter would turn out not to really be his daughter, or she would turn out to be someone else, or something else was going on. But I like that they didn't add anything, pile any more complications onto the script. This was just enough. And the film has decent pacing. As I said, it gets a little slow in places, but that's okay. It's got moments of humor. It shows some sense of brotherhood between the crew that Shaft puts together to save the kidnapped girl, and it's got some great tension. And as I said, you see that Shaft fits in. You know, he gets in where he fits in. He can talk to the bum on the street. He can talk to regular Harlem residents. He can talk to people in, you know, Village restaurants. He can relate to the brothers, the Lumumba group that is almost like the Black Panthers. And I think on one of these documentaries, I forget who said it, it might have been Nelson George, who said that basically the character of Shaft is Gordon Parks, because Gordon Parks was smooth, man. He was dapper. He was clean. He knew how to talk to people at all strata of society. And, you know, it's just interesting to note that Gordon Parks has a cameo in the film where he is a landlord, like, you know, Shaft is going around asking about where the leader of the Lumumba group is. And one of the doors he knocks on is his landlord, and the landlord opens the door and it's Gordon Parks. And Gordon says, hey, the guy owes me like 6 months back rent, which is a little bit funny. So, and of course, the music is fantastic. So I couldn't help but humming along to all of the music, which I noticed was slightly different for the film than it is in the produced album, but that's okay. It wasn't distractingly different. And it's amazing that I haven't seen it in all these many years, and I thought it was good. I enjoyed it. Like I said, I can't believe I haven't seen it before. I could see why Shaft as a figure of strong black manhood made such a difference within the culture and within film history, and why so many other films came after that emulated this pattern. Although some of the other blaxploitation films really focused on black versus white, us against the man, you know, ghetto life and all of that. But I'm so glad I saw it. So here I'm going to wrap up my talk about Gordon Parks, the incredible, multi-talented film director. There's so much more I could have talked about with him, but I just wanted to focus a little bit on the films. When you talk about somebody who's so accomplished, who has done so many things, you know, you can only really scratch the surface when talking about him. And I'm certainly no Gordon Parks scholar, though I definitely want to read more. I haven't read the books that he wrote, and so I would be interested in checking those out. But I hope you've enjoyed me talking a little bit about this wonderful piece of Black history, this wonderful man. And so thanks for listening to this. I might have a few final notes in a moment or two.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed the Gordon Parks section of the show. I just wanted to end with a few final notes for Black History Month about another topic entirely. So I saw an item in the New York Post recently that said Beyoncé and Zendaya to remake 1959 classic Imitation of Life film. According to this, Beyoncé would want to produce, and it's not clear if she would appear in the film, and then Zendaya would appear as Sarah Jane. Okay, apart from the fact that why would they remake this film yet again, and I say no to that, it kind of goes with the theme of the painful topic of passing in American history. The 1959 film starred Lana Turner, and it's about a white woman who wants to be an actress, who takes in an African-American woman. Their daughters are the same age, and so the black daughter is raised in the same home with the white daughter, except it's never addressed why the black daughter, Sarah Jane, is so fair. We have to assume that her father is white, but it is never addressed. And so part of the story, one of the most painful and memorable parts of the story for a lot of black audiences, is how Sarah Jane decides to pass, and she totally cuts ties with her own mother. And when she gets news that her mother passes, she comes home and basically throws herself on the casket, and it's really sad, and she apologizes. The 1959 Douglas Sirk directed film is a remake of the 1934 version of Imitation of Life, which is based on the same Fanny Hurst 1933 novel, and was directed by John Stahl. This time it stars Claudette Colbert in the Lana Turner role and Louise Beavers as the maid that she hires, the African-American woman, and Freddie Washington, who is an actual African-American woman, very fair-skinned, who played Sarah Jane. And the story is pretty much the same. And it's a very sad story about passing in our culture. And we just saw that played out in the wonderful Oscar-nominated film Passing that came out late last year. So the issue of passing is one that, or miscegenation, is one that has been addressed in a number of films. You know, and these are always sort of potboiler films about the tragedy of being the tragic mulatto whose parents are mixed. They don't fit into the white world. They don't fit into the black world. And, you know, it is tragic that our country, the history of our country, has included so much bias and so much prejudice that people feel that they have to masquerade as white in order to avail themselves of any sense of freedom or justice within the world. But that also means reneging or denying their own family roots. So a lot of times people who choose to pass cut all ties with their birth family so no one can discover their roots as a person of color. And so other films that have dealt with this, in addition to Imitation of Life, is the film Pinky, about a woman who is a nurse. And a key element of Pinky is that the role of Pinky is played by a white woman, Jean Crane. And she comes from a poor black background. She goes to nursing school. She goes north to be educated, to get work. And she has a white doctor fiance. And then she comes home to care for her aging mother. And she kind of disappears and doesn't tell anyone where she's going. And of course, her white fiance tracks her down and discovers, to his amazement, that Pinky is black. And it also shows the relationship that Pinky has with a rich white woman in the area whom she cares for, and the relationship that they develop. And so the woman overcomes her own prejudice, and after she passes away, she actually leaves Pinky her property. And Pinky ends up opening a school for disadvantaged children of color. It's another black and white film from the 1940s that a lot of black folks know, because, again, it deals with that issue of passing. A lot of other film stories, there was a film also called Crossed Boundaries, starring Mel Ferrer, of all people, as a black doctor who moves his entire family into a white town. And his wife is fair, he's fair, they have fair children. No one in the town knows that these people are black until the son decides that he wants to enroll in officer training in the army. And they get his records from his family and discover that he is indeed a Negro, which he didn't even know he was black. Can you imagine? He didn't even know. His sister didn't know. They have white friends. They go to white schools. They have white love interests. And so this boy, who I believe they lived in Connecticut, so when he finds out that he's black and he's been rejected from officer school, he just, you know, implodes, of course, and runs to Harlem. Because I guess that's where you run to when you discover you're black and you want to find what your black roots are about. And so you go to Harlem. It's a very interesting story because it's based on a true story. So I think you can find it on YouTube or even not Netflix. Yeah, YouTube, you should be able to find Across Boundaries. And I think the title is interesting, too, because, you know, there are clear-cut boundaries in our society, and you're not supposed to cross them. Another film that was interesting that had to do with miscegenation, and it's a small part of the story, is in a film called Band of Angels. So Band of Angels is from 1957. It stars Clark Gable, Yvonne DiCarlo, and Sidney Poitier, and Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. And so this is the Wikipedia description. The Civil War romance between a landowner, a former slave runner, and a Southern belle who is shocked to learn her mother was a slave upon her father's death. So Yvonne DiCarlo grows up on a plantation, the apple of her rich father's eye, and then her father passes away, and she discovers that her mother was a slave, and without her father's protection, she is now considered to be black, and she can be sold as a slave. And in fact, she is sold to Clark Gable, who of course is in love with her, but you know, he has to torture her a little bit about her background beforehand. So another film about a woman learning that she has black heritage and how that is treated within the New Orleans system. And it's also interesting because Sidney Poitier is in the movie, and you know, this is not a movie you would have expected Sidney Poitier to be in. He is actually a free man who called Rao Rao or something weird like that, who is actually educated, well-dressed. He has as much agency as Clark Gable, with whom he serves as sort of a man, his valet or whatever. So it's unusual to see Sidney in this type of a film. If you can see it, check it out. It's a classic potboiler that we don't see that much along the lines of, you know, Gone with the Wind, but set in New Orleans. So again, another interesting story about miscegenation and the idea of passing. And of course, you have the film Showboat, in which the Showboat's star is a singer named Julie, who befriends the captain's daughter, Magnolia. And Magnolia just loves her some Julie. And they don't find out that Julie is half black until she marries a white man. And because it has to be recorded in the town's records, it becomes common knowledge that Julie is black. And because of that, she is run off the boat in a white southern town. And so the story of Julie is a sad one, the tragic mulatto story that we've heard again and again and again, caught between two worlds, white and black, and how that impacts their identity, not only their identity, but their psyche. So it's another sad story about passing. Another film that I saw that had to do with miscegenation and passing, and there are a couple of stories, not so much about African American identity, but about Native American identity. And one of these films is a 1960 film called The Unforgiven, which I know most people know Unforgiven as a Clint Eastwood film from the early 2000s, I think, or was it the 90s? I forget. But The Unforgiven is a film starring Audrey Hepburn, as well as Burt Lancaster, Audie Murphy, Charles Bickford, Lillian Gish, and it's about a Western family just trying to survive on the, you know, on the frontier. And then it comes to light that Audrey Hepburn was not really born to this family. She was acquired by the mother during an Indian raid, and that she is, in fact, a full-blooded Indian. And when this comes to light, you know, the girl is already, you know, of marriageable age in her late teens, and literally the townspeople are marching to this family's home with you know, torches and pitchforks to throw the baggage out or kill her. And it's unbelievable the violence that ensues in this, that, you know, the issue of racism against Native Americans and those who are believed to have Native American blood is just, you know, again, a shocking, but also not so shocking depiction of racism in the American West during the 1800s. So these are just a few of the films that deal with racism as it pertains to the decision to pass, those who knowingly pass, and those who discover that they have blood that is quote unquote tainted. And we no longer use that terminology. But, you know, film always shows our history and cultural beliefs. And though a film about these topics would be approached differently today, it's really telling to see them in their original depiction. So I don't know that Imitation of Life should be redone at this point in history, because I can also only imagine that it would either try to explain too much, or, you know, in the interest of political correctness and racial justice, or it would dilute the story. You know, I'm really tired of all these remakes, I have to say. I think people should celebrate the original films. They should be shown and shown again. They should be shown in context. And, you know, we should continue to cultivate interest in classic films. So there you have it, my little talk on these types of films. I hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks. And I'll see you next month for Words on Flicks. Bye. Thank you.